From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the new ethical dilemmas surrounding death. Bioethicist Art Kaplan returns to talk with us about doctor-assisted suicide, dying in the era of managed care, and the future of dying in America. Also, Mark Eitzel of the band The American Music Club has his first solo album. He'll perform one of the songs. He was once described as determined to drag some kind of splendor and dignity out of loneliness and desolation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Columbia Records and its new album releases, Dead Man Walking, music from and inspired by the motion picture, and the companion piece, Dead Man Walking, the score.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dying isn't what it used to be. Now it's tied up with court cases and ethical debates over life support systems and doctor-assisted suicides. Yesterday, we spoke with the parents of Karen Ann Quinlan. 20 years ago, a landmark state Supreme Court decision enabled them to remove their permanently comatose daughter from life support. We also talked with medical ethicist Art Kaplan about the significance of the Quinlan case. Kaplan is back with us to talk about perhaps the most controversial aspect of dying today, doctor-assisted suicide. We'll also ask him to look ahead at the future of dying in America. Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of Moral Matters and is currently writing a book offering laypeople guidance on making decisions about dying. I asked Kaplan to explain the latest court decisions on doctor-assisted suicide.
Well, there have really been two. There's a California decision, a federal court, an appellate court, which considered a challenge to a Washington state law that banned assisted suicide. And then there's a New York case in which a court considered a challenge to the New York law. These federal courts govern a variety of states under their jurisdiction. So if you put it all together between the California one and the New York one, it's roughly about a third of the entire United States is governed by these two opinions. In the California case, the court said, we see a liberty interest in allowing people to ask for help in dying. They did it much as you would carving out Roe versus Wade or any privacy-based doctrine. They said the state should not be interfering in intimate decisions that people want to make about how they die. Very broad. While they did restrict this decision to the terminally ill, they basically said anyone can request assistance from anyone else and should be able to get it, doctors or anybody else. The New York case was more conservative. It basically said if you're almost dead, under not liberty interests or privacy interests, but under the equal protection notion, if you're lucky enough to be attached to a dialysis machine or a ventilator and you can die quickly without pain, why should you be disadvantaged just because you're not attached to some technology if you want to die quickly without pain? You should be able to get helped at the last moments of dying, maybe the last few days. So the New York court didn't see it the way the California court did, but both in a way did recognize something unheard of in the history of medicine, 3,000 years of medicine, that doctors should be enfranchised under certain circumstances to hasten death. And that is startling.
So what can doctors legally do now to hasten death?
Well, that's certainly the $24,000 question these days. You get lots of questions from physicians saying, well, can I do it? I would have to say, in my view, talking to various lawyers and judges, this case could be appealed to the Supreme Court. It probably will be. And I think we'll get a Supreme Court
opinion. The New York case can be appealed?
Yes, and the California one too. And I think we'll get appeals, and I think we'll have the Supreme Court forced to rule on assisted suicide within the next 2 years. If I was a physician and I wanted to use pain medication to help somebody in the last few days of life, and if I were worried about getting prosecuted for doing that, with these court decisions out now, I wouldn't worry. I think it is going to change clinical practice immediately. Before, I think some physicians used to think, I can't push the morphine, I can't push these drugs, they may cause death. What happens is morphine can suppress a patient's respiration, and if you're frail and dying, it can push you over the edge, you stop breathing, and you die. And doctors know that one of the effects of giving a lot of pain relief is to sometimes cause the patient's death. And they would hesitate in many parts of the country, fearing that they would be prosecuted or at least criticized for bringing about death. Even though these court opinions, in some sense, don't have any legislative force, I think it provides a safety blanket, at least in that area of assisted dying right now. I would think that we're going to see more aggressive pain control, and I'm happy about that. I can't believe that we've had people hesitating to push pain relief.
Now, the example you've given is if a doctor thinks that a painkiller would be helpful, but they're afraid to administer it because it might bring on death, now they could feel more comfortable in administering the painkiller. But what about the terminally ill patient who wants to die soon and says to the doctor, you help me die now. What's in the doctor's? What can a doctor do now?
We're still trying to carve out this right about assistance in dying. And I guess I'd say I'm not worried at all about the person on the brink of death who's going to be pushed over by the aggressive pain control. But what you're asking about now is the person who's some distance from that, saying, look, I've got my cancer, it's metastasized, I might be here for months, but I don't want to go through any more chemotherapy. I don't want that pain relief at the end. I think there, these court decisions are not going to change practice right away because I think people are still nervous that they might be prosecuted if they really hasten someone's death by a couple of months. The counterexample is Kevorkian. That's exactly who he's been dealing with. And to date, I guess there have been 6 prosecutions for 6 different cases, no results. I'm not surprised at that. It's important to know, Terry, that in the United States, in the history of cases where doctors have helped people to die on request, there's never been a successful prosecution, ever. No one has ever been successfully prosecuted as a physician or nurse for a mercy killing. On the other hand, no one wants to go through the rigmarole of the, I mean, it's one thing to say you're not convicted, it's another thing to say you're going to go through a trial and have the publicity. I don't think we're there yet in terms of hastening death by the month. On the other hand, I think we're going to get there soon.
Now, Dr. Kevorkian has been the most visible public symbol of doctor-assisted suicide. He's been on trial several times. There's a trial going on now. What kind of symbol is he to you as a bioethicist of the right to die debate?
A bad symbol. I think that Kevorkian, in the civil rights, anti-slavery movement in the Civil War, there was a man named John Brown who was kind of a fanatic who seized Harper's Ferry and kind of rabble-roused up people to revolt and rebellion, and people sang about John Brown's body moldering in the grave. He was kind of a almost a fanatical lunatic who just would not hear anything except the idea that he stood for a just cause. He did, in fact, bring attention to the issue of the emancipation of the slaves, and that was a great thing to do. But he was also a guy who was so fanatical and off the edge that once attention had been brought, things kind of went past him. That's exactly how I see Kevorkian. He's brought attention to the issue, but he is a guy who is obsessed with death. He has been throughout his entire medical career. He has a, if you will, pathological obsession with death. I mean, it goes back to his early days as a student when he would ask to be called in to watch people die to try and cope with or understand what was going on. I think he sees himself as above the law, as above any checks and balances. I think he's someone who has, for example, engaged in these suicides with people who, some of whom have psychiatric and mental illness problems and should not have been helped to die by him, many of whom didn't get adequate pain control. One case he's being tried on, the case of Margaret Wanzer, is someone who had a terrible ovarian and cervical problem and was in a lot of pain, but clearly had gotten lousy medical care. Another, the first person he helped to die, Janet Adkins, was told that she had Alzheimer's disease but had no symptoms yet. He's been way out on the edge of aggressively pushing the idea that suicide on demand is a doctor's mission. For anybody, he doesn't care if they're terminally ill. He doesn't much care if they're psychiatrically depressed. He doesn't much care if they're despondent. And so I think in some ways, great for bringing attention to the issue, but awful for showing us how to do it.
You wrote in a recent piece, our laws should make suicide hard, not easy. Suicide and assisting in a suicide should be messy, disturbing, troubling, trying, and difficult. Let me ask you to elaborate on that.
Well, I think what happens with the assisted suicide movement or the attempt to move forward in making it possible for doctors to help is that I think part of it is just to say, yes, we want the information and we want the means and we don't want people trapped in situations where they're caused to suffer. But some of it is to shift responsibility to somebody else. That is, when people talk about assisted suicide by physician, they are trying to make sure it gets done correctly, but they're also trying to shift guilt to somebody in a white coat. In secular America, our priests come in white coats and they work in big towers of steel and brick and glass that are our charts, and those are the medical centers. When you legalize assisted suicide and you don't put in a lot of checks and balances, when you don't ask people to undergo mandatory counseling or a competency test and so on, what I fear you're doing is you're making it an attractive nuisance. You're saying, please leave now. And it's easy to do. It's clean. It's organized. We play nice music. People come in white coats. It's not messy at all. That disturbs me. I think that you want people basically to be argued out of ending their lives. And we should have a healthcare system that takes the stance that it is absolutely the option of last resort to be thinking about this. But I'm very nervous that in a cost containment age, in an age when people are biased against the elderly, in a time at which all we talk about is rationing care, at a time at which 40 million Americans don't have health insurance, we're going to make this an option of first resort. And it doesn't even have to be by public policy. It just subtly gets into the culture. Yes, yes, we know you're dying and it's expensive and you're putting a lot of burden on the family. Why don't you talk to the nice man in the white coat who's we've trained very well to let you leave? That isn't the position I want to see this society in, although I understand full well that sometimes it may be better to leave than stay in terms of a terminal illness.
Are we in danger of heading in that position?
We are in extreme danger of heading in that position, in my view. I think that we are creating a right to die before we've got a right to health care. Sometimes I look around and I say, why are there no people on Medicaid who are in the Hemlock Society? I would like some people to introduce me to some minority members of the right to die movement. You won't find them. If there are, there's a handful of them. Why aren't they? Because there are a lot of Americans, probably 40 million, 50 million, who don't have health insurance. Their worry isn't about getting trapped by medical technology at the end of life. Their problem is to get into the emergency room when they need basic care. We've got a huge danger in front of us that people are not taking seriously. And I know this full well because I've watched this healthcare system and its struggle for health insurance and fair access for a long time. Many people, the upper class, the middle class, are terrified of a technological death trapped by care they no longer want. But there's another segment of American society who are terrified, terrified that if the doctor can kill them, they'll be killed prematurely to save money, or that they just won't get in the hospital at all. If we've got a system that has lousy health insurance, pathetic nursing home care, no hospice, rotten palliative care, and you put assisted suicide out there and just say, well, look, we've got this. We don't have to worry about all those other things. We're in grave danger of heading to a place that I don't think we want to be going to.
If you look at other countries, are there systems that we could learn from there?
Absolutely. The Dutch have been flirting with assisted suicide for years now. And it's funny, you know, the only real critics I sometimes think of the Dutch experience with assisted suicide are Americans who seem to always find something wrong with what they do. But I see things right with what they do. One thing they do is they've neutralized the financial issue. Every Dutch person who wants assistance in dying knows that they can stay in the hospital or the nursing home or in palliative care as long as they want. So it's truly a choice to leave sooner, not forced by some meter running in the background. Every Dutch person has a primary care person that knows them. Well, in the United States, many of us don't even have a doctor that we know by name. Is this the person who's going to counsel us and discuss our dying with us, some stranger? You need to have continuity and an identified caregiver if you're going to make this work well. The Dutch have waiting periods. You can't just simply be killed within 24 hours, Kevorkian style. You have to talk to a psychologist. You have to have your disease diagnosis confirmed by two separate physicians with some experience of dying. Not a dermatologist and a radiologist who set up a practice to say, well, yes, you're close enough to dead. That's good enough. Goodbye. There are many things to learn from the Dutch experience. I might add one other thing the Dutch have seen. They have found that there are people who come to them, to the doctor now and say, I want to die, who aren't terminally ill, There's a case coming up there this year, in fact, that involves a woman whose husband left her, whose two sons both died in terrible accidents, who lost her job and came down with some terrible disease like Parkinsonism. She basically said, I'm miserable. And if you want suffering, I'm suffering. Could I please be assisted in dying? Because you say that it's suffering that's the issue, not terminal illness. And she was assisted in dying, and the Dutch were shocked. They didn't mean for the right to be extended over to the despondent or the miserable. And that's something we should learn from, too. If we don't draw the line firmly at terminal illness, and you start just talking about helping the people who are depressed and burdened or bothered, and I am not talking in a joking way. I mean serious crises, horrible things happening to them. Nonetheless, I don't see medicine's role as helping them die.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Art Kaplan. He's the director of the Bioethics Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Art Kaplan. He's the director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also one of the organizers of a conference on the way we die. The conference is called Quinlan, a 20-year retrospective, and it's a retrospective 20 years after the New Jersey Supreme Court ruled that Karen Quinlan's parents had the right to take her off life support. Art Kaplan, at the conference that you've organized, Karen Quinlan, a 20-year retrospective, your subject is going to be the future of dying. What do you see when you look ahead at the future of dying?
Well, even though I have all sorts of doubts and reservations about the wisdom of liberalizing assisted suicide, I see an America 5, 10, 15 years from now that has legalized it. I think we're going to have legalized assisted suicide by doctor. I think it's going to be restricted to the terminally ill. I see an America that's going to be struggling then 10 or 15 years out with a couple of key policy questions. Are we going to spend money to fix the broken long-term healthcare system? We've got the lousy nursing home system, the pathetic palliative care system. Or will we in fact decide that's just not worth it and subtly evolve a notion of responsibility that says the responsible thing to do for the terminally ill, potentially expensive person is to avail themselves of the option of assistance in dying? I'm worried that that ethic is going to creep out there, not by government dictate. If you think about it, Terry, it's much the same way today if I said, oh, you're over 35 and you're going to have a baby. Have you had amniocentesis and look for genetic problems in the fetus? There's no law that says you have to do that, but culturally, we've decided that it's the responsible, the good thing to do. Similarly, no one's, I don't think, 15 years from now, there won't be any president that's issued some kind of ukase that says you must depart us at time X. But subtly, I think those pressures could be there. I'm very worried about that. I think we'll be debating two other things at that point in time. Will we extend the right to die to the cognitively impaired, the Alzheimer's patient, the Parkinson's patient, the stroke patient who's not suffering but is demented and, for many people, living a kind of existence that seems undignified and unacceptable.
And a lot of people say that's their worst nightmare.
And that isn't anything that the courts have talked about yet, and that's not where we are now, but I think that's where we'll be then. I think in some ways it's a case that can be made that to have to go through a spiral of dementia, not knowing friends and family, feeling like you're a complete burden on others, that will appeal to many people as the place where they would like their life ended faster. And I suspect one other area will connect to this, which I don't think many people have thought about now. We're getting very good in a different area of life at forecasting things. At my school, the University of Pennsylvania, we are becoming superb at genetic diagnosis. Well, what are the things we do? We can predict who's going to get Alzheimer's. We're starting to get good at who's going to get breast cancer. And 10 years from now, we're going to be excellent at these things. Well, the right to die movement is going to intersect predictions because what will happen is someone will say, my goodness, I've got this Alzheimer's gene and I'm going to get it. And now I'm 60 years old and I'm starting to have a hard time remembering things. Maybe I should be helped in dying now. I know what's in store for me. I haven't even started down the path toward this disease, but if I've reached the point where I know what's in store and I think either for cost reasons or liberty reasons or whatever reasons, I don't want to be there. That's where the future of dying is going to go. It's a mixture of forecasting ability and quality of life debates. We're talking now about pain and suffering for the terminally ill, but it's the quality of life issue that's going to be at the center soon.
The New York Times recently reported that as recently as the 1950s, more than half of American deaths took place in the home. But today, 80% of roughly 2 million American deaths a year take place in a healthcare institution, with the doctor controlling the manner and the timing of death. Do you think that's going to change? Do you think more people are going to be dying at home in the future?
I hope so. I think one of the ways to get a handle on the fears that people have about dying is to give them the opportunity to end their life with assistance. But another way to do it is to get them out of the ICU, to get them out of the acute care hospital. There are too many people dying in high-tech settings. You know, even if you come with a living will stenciled on your forehead saying, don't treat me, if you go to the ICU, people are trained to treat you. And it's like hopeless almost to try and turn off people of goodwill who want to do things. You shouldn't be in there. We should be dying more at home. We should set up other institutions for palliative care and hospice-like support. And I think, given the sad state of our nursing homes in this country, we should push harder for a new institution, the sort of palliative care place to die, where you're not going to be surrounded by all the technology and people won't be as fearful that they are going to be trapped on the ventilator and the respirator. They don't want the Quinlan type scenario. And I think if we could change the setting of dying, we'd go a long way toward making the need for assisted suicide minimal.
Do you have any suggestions about where or who someone can turn for guidance who has a complicated decision to make now about somebody in their family, or who just wants to think it through in advance so that they could face a complicated decision if the time comes with the mental resources to deal with it?
Well, if I was trying to think about where to go for some counseling, if I had a relative who was dying, I think I would go to people who are affiliated with hospice and just get information and have conversation with them. I think they're experienced in dying, usually with cancer, so it's a narrow range of experience so far, but nonetheless important. I think I'd also turn, if I was really trying to think about opinions and where to go, I'd find someone who had spent time as a nurse in an intensive care setting and talk with them about the technology and what's involved and why they see it as sometimes helpful and sometimes not. And the other place I'd turn for a little bit of advice and counsel is I might actually pursue one of the ethics people that now works at one of these medical centers. There is some accumulated wisdom. They're around, the people around, they sit on ethics committees. They sometimes have books and articles that can be useful to people. So I think I'd head in that direction as well. I intentionally didn't say I'd head off to my minister or priest. I assume people go there anyway, but that may not be where the greatest repository of wisdom is these days about dying in America, particularly in medical settings.
Art Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Harper San Francisco, publisher of the illustrated World's Religions by religion historian Houston Smith. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation about dying with bioethicist Art Kaplan. Also, Mark Eitzel performs a new song. His new album is his first solo effort since the breakup of his band American Music Club. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Art Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He's currently writing a book that will offer guidance to people facing confounding decisions about dying and helping their loved ones die. Do you think that your views on dying have changed a lot over the past however many years? I mean, since you've been an adult?
Yeah. Well, I got involved in medical ethics thinking about it when I was little because when I was a little boy, I had polio, and I was in the children's hospital in Boston, part of the Mass General. And one of the things I remember from that time, I was 7 years old, was that the doctors wouldn't tell us the truth. I knew there were lots of kids in my ward, and I was paralyzed, and there were a lot of iron lungs around and this sort of thing, who the doctors would come and say, Joey or Johnny or Susie is going to be okay. But then they would disappear, and you knew they weren't okay, and in fact, you knew they had died. We don't do that anymore. And I think that's good. It changed my feelings about how to treat not only adults, but children in terms of being truthful and honest when I could figure out what was going on at the age of 7. I think those same doctors, however, when I was sick as a little boy, were pretty good about spending more time talking and chatting both with me and my parents. And that's less so today. Now we've got a lot of technological managers. People swing into rooms, dial up the vent, play a little bit with the bags and the drips, and they're off to the next patient. And that kind of conversational side hasn't been filled in the healthcare system. So I've changed my thinking about we've got to do better at conversation. Even though we're more truthful, there are fewer people talking, and that's kind of an odd outcome. You want to have somebody there who can talk to somebody who's very sick, and the system isn't giving that. On the other hand, you want to make sure they're telling the truth, and that's something the system didn't used to do. More to the point is I've talked to families like the Quinlans and the Cruzans, and I've talked to some of the families of people that Dr. Kevorkian has helped to die, who in fairness to them have no criticism of him at all and no second doubts. And I've watched and participated once or twice now in assisted suicides myself, people with ALS, people who have Lou Gehrig's disease and basically have lost control of their bodies. I have changed my view somewhat. I think that I used to believe that family members couldn't be trusted and that you had to be skeptical. I've come to believe that they almost always can be trusted and that the burden should go on the healthcare system to prove why they can't be. Not everyone can, but most families most of the time want to do the right thing. And I think most of the fights and battles that I've seen over the years seem to me to be problems of miscommunication, misunderstanding, or just plain guilt feelings. And those need addressed.
When you say you've participated in assisted suicide.
Mm-hmm. Not hands-on, but witnessed. Been present at.
How come?
Asked to. In one case, surely I was there asked by someone because I'd known them and they had talked about doing this and they wanted me to come. And I'd spent all my time trying to talk them out of it. And I guess I went to talk them out of it right to the end. Someone who could only move their eyebrows and communicate by one of these computer-assisted devices had lost all control over her body. She ultimately decided that she didn't want to live anymore and wanted an overdose and had saved up the pills. And someone in her family gave her those pills. And I went there, I guess, trying to talk her out of it. And I spent my final minutes trying to talk her out of it. But I felt important. It was important to be there for her. She was my friend and I would respect her decision. I also knew that her life had become miserable and that she was authentic in her wish. She had been through the support and the psychiatrists and the conversations and everything anybody could have thought of. So as much as I didn't want her to do it, I thought she knew what she was doing when she did it.
Have you had to participate in a decision about bringing on the death of a loved one?
Well, indirectly, yes. Again, not so much assisted suicide, but I've certainly been present through the deaths of in-laws and parents where things have been disconnected, not done, and foregone. And I've thought a lot about those cases in my own personal life. And it's been interesting to me to watch two things. One, in theory, it's easy enough to say people should have the right to stop and disconnect and forego things when they're dying. I had my father-in-law who was dying of disseminated colon cancer. And I had to go in and tell him he was dying. And one of the things that sounded good in the abstract was the idea that he should have the right to know this information. But in reality, he had to tell me precisely when the time had come that he could hear what I was going to tell him about what his medical prognosis was. And it took a while for that to happen. And we tend to think, oh, yes, well, these communication and information things take place kind of as discrete events. We'll tell him on Tuesday. On Tuesday, he may not be in the mood. And then you may have to come back on Wednesday, and maybe you don't come back for another 2 weeks, and maybe he gets the idea that his hopes are going to go up and doesn't want to hear bad news at that time. So again, in a healthcare system that doesn't have a lot of continuity, where doctors change shifts all the time, this isn't a great way to handle this kind of talking, and I saw it with my father-in-law. The other thing that surprised me was, I think for a lot of us, we think of technology and we think, ugh, it's horrible. I wouldn't want to die demented or in pain or trapped. Fair enough. But I think we forget that many people also believe that suffering and redemption are part of what dying is about too. And one way you, in fact, redeem yourself is to take what technology can give you. And I think that was true for my father-in-law. He wanted to die as a person who was a fighter. He wanted to die as a person who had struggled, fought death, didn't go gently into the good night. All right. I would say, well, I'm not sure that this next operation or having this next medicine is going to do much for you, and it could actually make you suffer a bit more. In a way, I thought that would get him not to accept it. But on the contrary, it might mean that it was an obstacle to overcome or a way to show us that he was a virtuous person. And one of the things I've learned firsthand from watching people die is that you need to attend to this notion of their self-image. You have to give them permission to say, we know you're brave, but you don't have to take another round of chemotherapy to prove you're brave. Or it's okay to die without going one more bout of some technological gizmo. That's not going to prove anything to us. And I think we're lousy at that in general in the healthcare system because we're treating, again, death as if it's a metabolic event. It isn't. For human beings, it's a psychological, spiritual, it's a moral event.
As a bio ethicist, you have to keep in mind that death has a medical and a spiritual component, and we can't look at one and forget the other.
I think it's crucial to keep in mind that death is much more a spiritual component than a medical component. I guess if you ask me how my ideas really changed about dying, I probably watched this dying issue in some professional sense for 20 years, from a graduate student to today. I'm impressed that dying is much more spiritual than medical. We turn it into medical. The debates are about feeding tubes, and the debates are about shutting off dialysis, and the debates are about autonomy and being in control. Well, truth be told, most people when they're dying are not in a position to have a lot of autonomy. And what we're arguing about, I think, is technical things that deflect us from this very spiritual question. What's it for? What's it mean? How do you reconcile your life with the fact that it's coming to an end? How do you see yourself when you're having to take a long, hard look at who you are because you're dying? That's what's missing from the euthanasia debates, the assisted suicide debates. It's what I referred to as being the sloppy, messy, complicated part of dying. We're not picking that up when we just say, well, the court says there's a privacy interest in being allowed to have help in dying, or yes, the court says that you can disconnect the respirator and that's all right. Well, I guess you can do those things, but that's the start of a public policy. It's not the end of a public policy.
And how do we bring that spiritual component into the public debate?
The only way you can really capture the complexity, the thickness of dying, I think, is to insist that people have proper palliative care support. It's that tiny little flicker of the hospice that gives me some hope that we would let people die conversing with others who have some experience of what it means to die, and that they would be able to muster family resources and psychological support for the dying. It's not cheap. It's complicated. We don't do it very much in this society. But it seems to me creating the institution, if you will, of good palliative care support for people who are facing death or, in for that matter, dementia, severe disability, and being there for them and making sure that everyone has that option is what's missing from this whole right to die debate. It's not there. It's not being touted. No one's saying let's add it as an insurance benefit. I don't hear anyone calling for the creation of the institution of the home hospice or the palliative care institution. But that's where I think we have to turn. Otherwise, I suspect we'll achieve exactly what we didn't want to. We'll really wind up turning death into simply a legal medical matter. And it isn't that. And no one will feel especially happy if they're coldly put to death by a guy in a white coat any more than they did lying there tethered to a machine beyond the time at which they thought it made sense. Neither, in fact, I suspect, is going to get us to the place we want to be at in trying to cope with this phenomena of dying.
Art Kaplan, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks.
Art Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's the author of Moral Matters. This is Fresh Air. The New Yorker described singer-songwriter Mark Eitzel as perhaps the finest poet of tenderloin passion and despair since Tom Waits. He was once named best songwriter in a Rolling Stone critics poll. For 10 years, he was the lead singer and songwriter with the San Francisco-based band American Music Club. Just as the word depressed is usually used to describe the mood of Eitzel's songs, the word underappreciated was often used to describe the band. In spite of all the critical praise, this indie rock band never achieved commercial success. The band has broken up, and Eitzel has his first solo album called 60-Watt Silver Lining. Before we meet him, let's hear a track from the record. This is his song, Saved.
Your warm embraces thrill me. In your arms I fall like a star. Rain or shine, come what may. In your arms the cold seems far away. There's no safety in this world. I have no time for good luck charms. But I still long for your touch. 'Cause I know I'm saved. I know I'm saved. I know I'm saved. I know I'm saved in your arms.
Mark Eitzel, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
You describe this song as your Burt Bacharach style song. What strikes you as Bacharach-ish about it?
It's a real straight ahead song with very defined limits. You know, it's a romantic tale and in a very kind of simple kind of storytelling kind of manner, which is the hardest thing for me to do. But I don't know. And I saw Barbra Streisand like last year perform, and she was doing all these kind of Burt Bacharach songs, and I was very impressed.
And you had her in mind when you wrote this?
Oh, absolutely, I did. I don't know if she ever do it, but sure. I mean, I from Polygram I got a listing of who what artists need songs. And I don't know, I wrote this for her Christmas album.
Oh, yeah, sure. But where are the high notes where she gets to show off the upper register?
Well, you know, there's no safety in this world. It's very Barbra Streisand, come on. I mean,
this is your, go ahead.
I mean, there's no high notes because I can't sing them, but she could, you see.
Well, you do have a key change later on. She could just go into a much higher key.
Right.
So this is your first album solo without American Music Club.
Right.
What's different to you about this record than the ones with the American Music Club?
Well, not much, really, because it's still my songs and it's still basically my arrangements for them. And it's, you know, they're all based on my chords, the tunings I have in my guitar. The only difference is that I basically told everybody what to play, you know. I composed all the music in my computer before I even showed up for rehearsal, and I said, well, this is the bass note, this is the bass line, this is what you play on drums, this is what you play on piano, with some interpretation from everybody. But basically, I called all the shots, and that was the difference. But the American Music Club is democracy, and I didn't really have, I just had a fifth voice, and that was it.
And you didn't want an equal voice, you wanted to be the guiding spirit.
The ruler, yes.
The ruler.
Yeah, I mean, democracy is fine, you know, but after a while, it just got unwieldy for me. I just felt like I'd grown to a certain extent. I couldn't create farther in that environment. You know, I know that sounds kind of pretentious, but it's true. Mm-hmm. So I sat him down one day, and January 1st, 1995, I sat down. And I said, "Okay, I'm firing the managers." I'm changing my life. So I'm not going to be in a democracy anymore. And if you're not happy with that, then I'm quitting the band. And they weren't happy with it, so I quit the band.
So this is your first solo album without American Music Club. Something that's right. stayed the same is that most of the songs are still pretty, depressive type of type of songs. Do you think of that as being your songwriting persona, or do you think of that depressive atmosphere as being your inner life?
Both, you know. I mean, I've always liked really melancholy songs. You know, I've always found joy listening to that kind of music. I mean, so it's, for me, it was never a matter of depressing or not depressing. It was always a matter of, wow, this is great. I like this. In terms of songwriting persona, yeah, I'm always singing from a point of view of somebody who's trying to survive through victimization of some kind. And that's, maybe I'm not doing it in the right way, but I think it's important, you know, to incorporate all the feelings that are involved with that into the moment, you know. I don't know. I'm wrong, but that's how I feel.
I'm going to pause here to show something really out of character.
Uh-oh.
And on an earlier record, you did a voice and piano version of "On a Clear Day You Can See Forever" from the show with music by Burton Lane and Alan J. Lerner. What a totally out of character thing for you to do. I actually like the recording, an interesting
Thanks.
Side of you. Tell me why you did this, and then we'll hear a bit of
it. Well, it's just after I saw her perform, you know, and I just was
so,
like...
So who performed?
Barbara.
Oh, Barbara Streisand sang this.
Yeah. And, well, it's her classic hit, right? And it's one of those weird 60s songs that sort of like billows like a big cloud, you know, and just sort of like it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it was sort of a challenge to do it, actually, for my friend. And I just had to do it as a sort of a thing. I got nothing to say about it. We've recorded the day Kurt Cobain died. That's all I have to say.
Did you really? Oh, yeah. And it's such like the optimistic song, too, which makes it even more out of character for you. There's never a clear day in your songs, but go ahead.
I don't know. What's optimistic about anything, really? You know, it's like it's on a clear day. Rise and look around you, and you'll see who you are. I know, is that such a good thing all the time, you know? Or maybe it's some kind of like weird, maybe that's some kind of weird drug dream, you know? I don't know. I mean, I think it's a beautiful song.
Mark,
that's all. It's a great melody, you know? I'm just trying to reach towards writing beautiful songs, and you know, if it dips into that catalog, that's my business, really.
Okay, so this is probably the only song where you're going to sing about the light of your being shining every star.
Well, Jesus, I mean, it's like, you know, why not?
Oh, it's a great melody. It's a nice melody.
It is.
Okay, let's hear Mark Eitzel. Who's the pianist on this?
Bruce Kappen. He's also the pianist on my new record as well.
Okay, this is On a Clear Day.
On a clear day, rise and look around. And you'll see who you are. On a clear day, how it will astound you that the glow of your being outshines.
What were your early songs like?
Oh, geez. I try to forget. Well, my early songs are like my songs now in a lot of ways. You know, I try to keep, they're really simple musically, and they were really, like, odd, sort of, like, odd kind of tunings and odd chords. I remember lots of E minor being played. I think that a lot of my earlier songs were about me. You know, I've always been a kind of a self-absorbed, morbid kind of guy, so they've all been about me, really.
And in that respect, nothing's changed?
in that respect, of course, nothing has changed. Well, I have tried to broaden that a little bit, but yeah.
My guest is Mark Eitzel. He has a new album called 60 Watt Silver Lining. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mark Eitzel. For 10 years, he was the lead singer and songwriter with the band American Music Club. The band has broken up, and he has a new solo album. Tell me more about what it was like to be in the band, often on the road, trying to break through.
Well, we became the most aggressive folkies you've ever seen in your life.
Folkies?
Folkies, you know, because the kind of music we've always played has been really quiet. And during the 80s, quiet music was the era of garage rock, and my particular idiom was punk rock at the time. I mean, Husker Du, Replacements were all the bands that I admired, but the kind of music that I listened to was Nick Drake and John Martin and stuff like that. And most of, when you go to a small bar, most times people want a drink and they want something that's going to be louder than them screaming over their drinks. So when you come on stage and you play really quiet, really sad songs that have too many words, if you don't have some kind of attitude, you're just gonna have people throwing beer bottles at you, you know?
So did you develop an attitude?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think the thing with AMC was whenever I did a solo acoustic song, all the members of the band would come and stand by the edge of the stage with their arms folded, staring at the crowd, making them shut up.
Was that effective?
It was actually kind of effective. At least it made people laugh, which is half the battle, you know? I mean, it was, you know...
This is like your own version of having the fruit of Islam protecting you or something.
I know, exactly, you know, exactly. It's like, and we did that once. Once we did that in Switzerland, we had people with fake submachine guns flank me all night. You know, it was like pretty funny, actually.
You've brought your guitar with you. Would you play something from the new record?
Yeah, sure.
One of your songs?
All right. This is a song called Aspirin. It's about a friend of mine in Los Angeles, and it's like, this is it.
Is the pain they cause you gonna be your final destination? It's just gonna make you hate your own reflection. You think you should endure it, but you know you're gonna give in. Tell me why such a cheap thing always hides the real thing. My love, though all you had was stolen, I hope your heart won't always be broken. The little hero who took away your life busy feeling hate, busy being proven right. Always looking in the mirrors, trying to see bullets instead of eyes. Sees a handsome devil who's the spirit of the skies. Relax, my love. It's just the gates of hell swinging open. I hope your heart won't always be broken. When hate seems like the sun in the heaven, and there's nowhere to run, and no way to get even, and you hide in the shadow of your own making. You hold your head high, even though your heart's breaking.
That's nice. Do you perform literally solo like that, just you and your guitar very often?
Yeah. Well, yes, I do, and yes, I and no, I don't. I mean, I do it when the situation's going to be right, when it's going to be a receptive crowd. And it's going to be enjoyable for them. I did a tour recently with a band called Everything But the Girl, and I admire them a lot. I found, however, that when I perform a lot of these songs in a discotheque where they like to play, you know, I'm like the sad folky from hell, you know, the sad folky from nowhere, who comes from nowhere and then leaves the stage and goes nowhere, you know, and nobody really cares what happens, and that seems a little hard. I'd rather perform with a band if I do that, because it's more entertaining for them and it's more entertaining for me, and, you know, you have more fun. A lot of people, when they go out, they're just, you know, rightly so, they just want to have a good time. And sometimes my songs require a little more than that.
Mark Eitzel, thanks a lot for talking with us.
It's been an honor. Thank you.
Mark Eitzel's new CD is called 60 Watt Silver Lining. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan, too, directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Can't work that specs since 1970. Right after Hate Street finally choked on its own vomit. An impartial smile made him a gentleman. Some bartenders.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Columbia Records and its new album releases, Dead Man Walking, music from and inspired by the motion picture, and the companion piece, Dead Man Walking, The Score. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of Blue Note Records, perhaps the world's most famous jazz label. We'll talk with Charlie Lurie and Michael Cascuna. They've produced many Blue Note reissues, and they've collaborated on a new book of jazz photos by Blue Note's co-founder, Francis Wolfe. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.